I'm Martin Reeves, chairman of the B. Stu Henderson Institute. Welcome to our Thinkers and Ideas podcast, where we discuss important new books and ideas in business. Joining me today is Akshat Rathi. Akshat is a senior reporter at Bloomberg who focuses on climate and energy. He hosts a very well-known podcast, The Zero Podcast, where he discusses the technologies, policies, and tactics to fight climate change. He's won awards for his work, including the Whitman Bassoff Award for the best international reporting on environmental issues. And he's here today to discuss his new book, Climate Capitalism, Winning the Global Race to Zero Emissions, which came out in October of 2023, in which he tells stories about individuals that have made progress in tackling humanity's greatest challenge. So I look forward to discussing your book with you, Akshat, and thanks for joining me.
Well, thanks for having me on the show, Martin.
So what is the main intent of your book? You write a lot in the course of your work. You must have had some sort of purpose in mind. Is it to show us that climate is fixable, or to demonstrate the important role that individual efforts make? Or what did you have in mind for writing the book?
When I got into writing the book, there was a sense that whatever we are doing to try and tackle climate change isn't working. It's never going to work unless, as many activists said, you take down the capitalist system, because that's been the source of the problem. And I wanted to investigate that idea because I grew up in India, a country that went from, after independence, socialist roots to capitalist roots. And I saw what growth and what economic development can do, where my grandfather went from being a factory worker to my father getting an education, starting his own business, to me being able to study abroad because my father could afford to send me abroad. And that level of growth was one that I wanted to investigate whether climate could be addressed at all. And all around the world, I found solutions within the capitalistic system. We're able to address the climate challenge.
Right. Indeed, you talk about capitalism not being the problem, but the corruption of capitalism being the problem. And you talk about something called climate capitalism, which presumably has special elements or some things fixed. So tell us about the delta between climate capitalism and regular capitalism. What is fixed? What is removed? What is extended by your conception?
At the very basic level, it's the fact that capitalism, as we have run over the past 100 years, 200 years, has not taken into account the impacts, the costs of many of its profit-driven motives. These are not just carbon pollution, but all other forms of pollution that we do not count. And so once you start including that, it automatically has to modify the way capitalism has worked. Now, in practical terms, that looks like the Inflation Reduction Act in the US, or the European Green Deal in Europe, or the Chinese goal to try and become champions of the new technologies that we are going to need in the 21st century.
So it's the inclusion of externalities. Is that the heart of it, or are there other elements too?
It is, but it is not just the inclusion, but it's also how to address those externalities. So how to come up with the policies that you need to be able to modify the capitalist system that exists and is, no doubt, contributing to the problem.
I guess given the breadth of your work, you're probably familiar with the work of Kohei Saito, who published this book, Slowdown, that was a bestseller. I think it sold 500,000 copies in Japan. He's just published an English version, and he proposes almost the opposite, at least it seems that way, to your proposal. He says that capitalism is the problem. The capitalism is predicated on maximizing growth, and maximizing growth is the maximization of consumption and the exploitation of resources, and therefore he proposes some very radical solutions, sort of climate communitarianism, essentially, which de-emphasize growth. Is this just labels, or is there a substantive difference here, and what would be your response to his proposal?
There is a lot of difference between the two ideas, and in recent years, there has been growing interest in this idea of degrowth. There has been a bunch of academic work, not just in Japan, but around the world. The basic idea, if you distill it down, at least the one that could practically work, is you lower the amount of growth that is happening in developed countries because they are already so rich, and even maybe degrow the economy there, but allow developing countries to keep growing because they have so much more potential for their economies, but also their people. And that is perhaps the most reasonable argument you can make for the degrowth movement. But at no point do they talk about the politics of degrowth. If you're looking at what's happening in the US with climate politics, any intervention that is seen to take away the American way of living is attacked and is used as a tool to try and take away what are really good solutions that would bring prosperity.
So your perspective would be that degrowth works in principle, but it's just politically infeasible. Is that the idea?
That's right. But also, it is important to recognize that it's not just about growth. We do have to become a lot more conscious about how we are growing. And that is bringing in externalities, that is bringing in policies that will have multiple benefits, not just reducing emissions, but also other desirable outcomes.
So your book has a very interesting format, and let's get into the ideas in the book now. You don't talk in terms of theories or prescriptions. It's mainly a series of individual heroic stories about people who have made substantive progress against climate change. And I'll just tick through them for our listeners because we probably won't have time to go through them all. You have The Bureaucrat, which is a story of the rise of Chinese electric vehicles and the role of a particular bureaucrat in enabling that. You have a chapter called The Winner, where it's about Chinese leadership in lithium-ion batteries. You have something called The Doer, solar power in India. The Fixer, which is about fixing institutions like the International Energy Agency. The Billionaire, Bill Gates. The Wrangler, which is about a story about carbon capture and storage, etc. And before we get into some of those stories, I'm wondering, why did you choose that format? Are you trying to show us that individuals can make a difference or that contributions can be very different? Are you trying to give us hope? Or why this format?
First and foremost, I'm a journalist, and my job is not to give you theory. My job is to tell you what's happening in the world in the form of stories that would be readable. But crucially, individuals do drive action. However, they do so in a system. So all of these stories, as you said, are situated in different places: India, China, the US, Denmark, France. These are places that have very different politics, very different economics. And I wanted to show that even within those contexts, individuals can make big difference, that these solutions can be scaled. And together, I think, as a framework, they show what are the ingredients that are needed for this massive transformation to zero emissions.
Right. Well, let's see if we can get through a couple of those stories. I didn't know the story about the person behind Chinese EVs, so perhaps you could tell us about that one, and maybe about the creation of Ørsted from a fairly traditional oil company. Tell us about Chinese EVs.
So Wan Gang is the character, and he was born in China, studied auto engineering, went to Germany, got a PhD, worked in Audi, rose up the ranks. But then he looked back at his own country and recognized that if Chinese wanted to live the kind of lifestyle that Germans did, they would burn 16 times the oil per person. And there's just not enough oil for that. So when he got a chance to pitch himself to the Chinese leadership, he said, look, if you want an advantage in the 21st century on auto manufacturing, don't try and make the internal combustion engine better. Go for something that would actually bring you benefits and will be workable because you need a different form of fuel to power it. And that's the bet that the Chinese leadership listened to and then backed him, because they spent $60 billion in his time as the Chinese science minister to support electric car manufacturing and lithium-ion battery manufacturing. And the results are there for all to see.
Yeah, it's a remarkable story about an individual driving that enormous change. And what about Ørsted? I guess if we think about the least tractable industries in terms of climate change, we think about, you know, an oil company trying to change its spots. It seems like a fundamentally very difficult thing. But then there's the story of Ørsted. Tell us about Ørsted.
Well, Ørsted's story in some way is one that people kind of know of, at least if you've gone to business school, because it's sort of pitched as this idea that an oil and gas company can be fully transformed into a renewable energy company. But it's only half the story. That's the story of the past decade. But the story of the making of Ørsted is actually 6 decades long, because it started off as Danish Oil and Natural Gas as a state-owned instrument where the state drove what Dong, as it was known, needed to be in the time and the need that was. So when it went through an oil and gas crisis in the 70s and 80s, that's what it did. When it went through an energy markets crisis in the 90s in the European Union, it became a utility company alongside its natural gas world. And then finally, in the 2000s and 2010s, when Denmark wanted to become a climate champion, as did all other European countries, it became an instrument to try and use what were some of its key advantages, such as building offshore wind turbines, which it had done in the 90s as an experiment, but then use them and actually create a business model. So a lot of policy innovation went into sort of like experiments that were tried and failed, but it wasn't just the company driving it, it was the state alongside it.
If I think about Ørsted being an exception, you know, one of the few oil companies that did really change its orientation, what is it that primarily enabled that? Was it individual initiative? Was it the fact that it was state controlled and therefore there could be a mandate? It wasn't ruled by the markets. It was directable, or was it a very high degree of, one presumes, adaptability? What were the key ingredients that enabled them to change the spots?
I would say three things. Even as the state owned the company, it was allowed to experiment with different technologies all through those six decades. And so offshore wind was just an experiment that was tried, and they kept tinkering at it. Second, it was state-driven, so there was 50% ownership of the state, and that allowed it to take risks in a way that other companies typically wouldn't, who have shareholders in the market that demand a certain return at a certain pace. And the third one is that it was in an environment where there was clear policy direction towards clean energy. And so even as the state doesn't interfere in the operation of the company, it did give it direction for where it needed to go. And those three things put together allowed it to move away from what is a pretty lucrative business even today, which is oil and gas, to what is a shaky business, which is offshore wind, but has a bright future.
Now, obviously, any individual company listening to this can't exactly replicate the circumstances of any one of your stories. But I think there are some common denominators or some essential ingredients. And you point to the role of technology, regulation, leadership, and finance, I think, as those common denominators. Tell us what these stories have in common.
That it isn't one thing, that there isn't a silver bullet solution that's going to work either in one sector of the economy or in one country, that you need a mixture of these things. And depending on the politics and the economic heft of the places that you are, the solutions may vary. So what you need to know is you need these ingredients, but you also need to be agile. The difficulties you face in what is an unprecedented change at an unprecedented scale will require you to learn from doing, learn from your failures, but also learn from your successes. And finally, that this is not happening just in your own domain. All around the world, all countries and all companies are grappling with this challenge. So there are lessons that you can learn from others that can apply. And they may be Indian lessons that are applied in Kenya and British lessons that are applied in Denmark. So there may be places which have to overlap in a certain way for those lessons to be transferred, but that certainly can happen.
I was looking in a way for another type, one more chapter in a way, which is, I don't know, I might have called it hyperscale or something, which is you have these individual solutions, which are impressive. Essentially, it's people with very perhaps unpromising starting points in some cases and a vision and some support from government and an exploitation of a technology. But we're not in a particularly good place with respect to climate change. These companies you talk about, these individuals you talk about are still very much exceptions. So I guess the next stage of the game is in scaling and replicating these stories so that we have sufficiency in the whole. So what are the magical ingredients that would take us from an interesting collection of exceptional case studies to solutions at scale?
I wouldn't say they're all exceptional case studies. Some of them are. I would say the case study for Ørsted is an exceptional one because an oil and gas company hasn't fully transformed to a renewable energy company. But case studies of how Chinese electric car makers became the giants they did, it's not one company, it's the entire industry. And it's not just the industry in China, it's the entire industry around the world. So all other car companies have been forced to reckon with this change. So with that in mind, I would say the ingredients that make this work, the sort of climate part of capitalism, is that governments are now having to correct a market failure. And that requires a little more direction than governments have had in the past to direct an economy. And that, of course, is seen from some political lenses as a bad idea. But if you recognize that climate challenge is a big one and that it's going to eventually affect you regardless of whether you're part of the solution or not, then you must recognize that that direction, done right, done with an input from industry, is necessary. And so what governments have to do is to direct those markets, not take away competition, but show clear direction for where those companies need to go and allow for a competition of ideas within that direction to win as to whatever the best one is.
I'm a consultant, you're a journalist. I guess we're both aware of the limitations of case studies. when one proposes a case study, somehow people expect the case studies to be perfect in all respects and to be good forever. And of course, that's never the case. And in the case of a couple of companies you quote in your book, you know, they've had their problems in precisely the areas you're talking about. Unilever was the epitome of the CSR, the responsible climate-sensitive company, but a lot of that appears to have unraveled in recent months. And Ørsted, of course, has had some recent financial woes and divestments. Do these setbacks in any way undermine the case that you're making?
I don't think so, because it's not about the case studies per se. It's about showing how you got to a point of success. And as there are failures in some places, there are successes in other places. So the Chinese EV industry is now even bigger than when I stopped writing, when I put the pen down on this book in 2022. BYD is now much bigger than Tesla. And so the solar industry in India, for example, is booming. It has had a slower growth rate than people had imagined, but it is going not just in India, but also taking those ability to build in a developing country into other places. And so the ingredients are there. And I think what's to be taken from those case studies is those ingredients, not the specifics.
Right. You touched on politics, and you say in the book, democracy can be the biggest rein on the excesses of capitalism. And indeed, many of your stories show a critical role for government. It's almost that each story contains an element of entrepreneurialism and an element of governance. We're not in a particularly healthy context politically, are we? Democracy is said to be in retreat, and populism on the rise, and social division, controversy and friction on almost everything, hard to get big things done in democracies around the world. Can we scale and multiply the stories that you talk about in your book in the current political context?
I'm sad to say, but it is true that climate impacts are going to get worse, which means migration patterns are going to change, which means food security and energy security are going to be challenges. And as we have seen, many of these right-wing twists that we are seeing around the world have to do with the specific outcomes of either food security or energy security. Many of the populist strands have to do with migration, may have to do with immigration. Those macro trends will be made worse by climate change. So in a way, you don't kind of have an option. You either address the problem or it keeps getting worse.
That's logically the case, but can we act on that logic in the current political context?
Well, I take hope in the fact that if you take the hardest form of multilateral diplomacy, John Kerry, the US envoy, calls it supercharged multilateralism. This is what happens at these COP meetings, these annual conferences. Well, all countries have to come together and all have to agree on a single piece of text to move the ball forward. And they've been slow and bureaucratic, but every few years they make a step change, and that step change does lead to real world outcomes. It happened in the Paris Agreement in 2015, it happened at Glasgow in 2021, and at least for now, climate people say it has happened in Dubai in 2023. And those outcomes make a difference down all the way to policy and individual choices. So even as we will see a few steps back, most of the steps have been in the forward direction. And that's going to be the case for the transition. It's not going to be a smooth curve from where we are all the way to zero. It will be a spiky journey.
Some of your examples, many of your examples, are a story of a company finding a strategy to be profitable with a climate solution. Sometimes improbably, something that isn't thought to be potentially profitable actually turns into a good business, as with Ørsted or Chinese EVs or solar panels. Is this possible in every sector, or are there some very important sectors where that's just not tractable? And if so, what can we do there?
It's not possible in all sectors, and that's a very good thing to recognize early. Infrastructure in general is a very good place to think about the problem. So you cannot have a competition on the electric grid. It's just not worth having two different grids. You want to have one. It's the same thing with the pipeline network, same thing with the road network, same thing maybe eventually with the charging network for electric cars. That kind of infrastructure has to be regulated monopolies or government-owned. And until we reckon with that fact, I think we are going to struggle, as we are seeing in many of the utilities in Western countries, struggling with the economics of making renewables profitable. in other places like electric car manufacturing or in heat pump sales, for example, there should be competition because you can make better products, you can make them cheaper, you want the customer to have the benefit, the best possible product that they can buy. So it's good to recognize where competition is beneficial and where regulated monopolies should be better regulated.
What can we do in the tricky area of fossil fuels? Because fossil fuel companies are big, powerful. They have attractive, profitable businesses. Demand is increasing. I know you have the example of Ørsted, but it appears to be very hard for these companies to move to different business models. And of course, unless we somehow break that dependence on fossil fuels, that's going to impede progress. So what can we do on fossil fuels? What's the transition path, as it were? How do we get from A to B?
It is perhaps the greatest challenge for climate capitalism because fossil fuel and fossil fuel industry is perhaps also the greatest corruption of capitalism, right? They've created a structure where they're so profitable and pay nothing for the pollution that they cause. Well, I say nothing, at least in most parts of the world, it's nothing. You know, an economist will tell you, put a global carbon price and fossil fuels will start to decline in use and clean energy will take hold. Unfortunately, again, it's the politics of a global carbon price. That's never going to happen. We know that. So what's the solution? Well, we're getting a piecemeal outcome, right? In places like the US, you get tons of subsidies, which are an implicit carbon price on trying to promote these clean energy. But in places like Europe, you do have an emissions trading system, and that is putting an explicit carbon price. And now what Europe is doing is actually applying that to other countries by putting a carbon border adjustment mechanism, basically a tariff, where if you are exporting your goods from China to Europe, well, you will have to pay the same carbon price that European companies are paying. And that's the reason for China and now India to start to think of a large carbon pricing system within their own countries. So it is starting to happen that these externalities are being priced, but the fossil fuel industry has really gotten away with it. And its profit margins are because it doesn't pay the price on pollution.
Yeah, I must follow up on that as an artificial American or European. One of the things we do is we analyze the prospective growth of the corporate economy globally. And not surprisingly, it says that most of the prospective growth is coming from places like China and the US, driven very much by technology. And Europe looks to be stagnant prospectively. And some people have linked that to this zealousness around things like privacy regulation and technology regulation and climate regulation. Do you see something the other side of that tunnel in the sense that could one imagine, is it plausible to imagine a European renaissance through embracing these apparently growth-constraining activist regulations, let's say?
Hard to see that. I mean, the innovation ecosystem that the US has built is one that is the source of jealousy for not just the Europeans, but also for the Chinese and also for the Indians. And it's an ecosystem that's been hard to replicate. But what Europe does have is, for now, political certainty on all sides of the divide to try and push for climate action. So nobody has really cracked it. There is no magic bullet to solve this. And I think you're getting different bets in different regions. The European approach is more sticks than carrots. And so far, it has worked better than the US in terms of total emissions reduced. European countries as a whole are doing better than the US, and some European countries are doing far better than the US. So let's not lose sight of the fact that that is the case currently. But you're right. In the future, if the technology areas that are growing take the US even further and grow the gulf between Europe and US in economic growth, can Europe sustain its carbon cutting ways? That's a good question.
You more or less said earlier in our interview that your job as a journalist is to communicate and inspire. Supposing a CEO picked up your book, and let's imagine that CEO has the normal things going on. He has ESG goals. He or she has 2050 net zero goals, ESG reporting, attends COP summits, but they're hardly moving the needle. They wouldn't qualify as a case study in your book. If they wanted to step up their efforts very strategically to create true change in their company and their sector, what's the recipe? Where would they begin? How would they think about that problem?
We know that to address the climate challenge, you have to get to zero emissions. Until we stop greenhouse gas emissions, the planet will continue to warm, extreme weather will continue to get worse. So you have a big macro trend. And for business leaders, having a certain macro trend of that kind is actually a blessing. And so if I were a CEO, I would look at my company, I would look at the economic sector in which I'm operating, and I would look at what is needed to get that sector to zero emissions, and what are the advantages, technologies, products, innovations that I could bring that would bring competitive advantage for my company in a market that will go to zero emissions one way or another, and find those products and invest in them and provide that long-term certainty of investing them. Talk to your shareholders that this is where we are taking the company. Give transparent, detailed information about your journey and communicate what is working and what is not working. It's not going to be easy, but that's where leadership counts.
So unfortunately, our time is coming to a close. Maybe if I can, I'd love to end with a few more personal questions. So I couldn't tell whether your book was optimistic or whether it was telling us or inducing us to be optimistic. So I wanted to ask you, what is your strongest ground for optimism on climate change? And what are you most pessimistic about?
I'm most pessimistic about the unknowns. There are a number of tipping points that we are likely to trigger as we go crazy with the climate system. You know, the Amazon rainforest becoming a savanna, the methane in the Arctic Circle starting to get released, the breaking off the West Antarctic ice sheet causing huge amount of sea level rise, the circulation of the Atlantic warm currents slowing down and putting Britain, where I live, into a frozen state, and of course causing all sorts of other problems. We just don't know when we'll trigger them in many cases, and we might only know them after we've triggered them. And that is terrifying to me. But I would say the optimism side is the starting of the book, where I wanted to see whether what we're doing is working or not. And everywhere I go, I can see solutions starting to work. I can see more people interested in working on solutions. I can see more governments thinking about putting in policies or putting in money towards these solutions. And that trend, despite what we are seeing on the politics a little bit here and there, has not gone into reverse. Overall, it's going in the direction that it needs to.
So I know what you're saying we should do, but I'm wondering what your prognosis is, where you think we'll be in, say, 20 years' time. Do you think we'll inflect that emissions curve, or are you cautious about that?
Again, not in the business of doing predictions, but again, if I look at it in history, when the Paris Agreement was signed, the world had the possibility of hitting 4 or 5 degrees Celsius of warming. Now, the worst case scenario takes us to 3 degrees Celsius of warming. And those may not sound like large numbers, but the difference is enormous in how many parts of the world could have become uninhabitable versus how many won't now. And so roughly, we're going in the right direction. And that does mean an emissions peak is coming. You just look at what China is doing, the largest emitter, right? 28% of greenhouse gas emissions, deployed more solar panels in 1 year than the rest of the world did in that year, or more solar panels than the US has ever deployed just last year, and is going to repeat that feat again this year. So I take hope in the fact that that will bring change. And once you start to see that change, maybe there's momentum building for more emissions reduction to happen faster.
So perhaps we should seize that note of optimism to end there. So thank you very much, Akshat, and congratulations on your new book.
Thank you.
I've been discussing Climate Capitalism, Winning the Global Race to Zero Emissions by Akshat Rathi, which came out in October 2023. The thing that was most interesting for me about the book was in the individual stories of agents in Akshat's case studies, just how much can be achieved with so little. So in a sense, it's a book full of leverage points and inducements for individual action. And it covers a fairly broad waterfront of industries and countries. So I'd propose that it's a very interesting book for us to all read. If you like this conversation, make sure you're subscribed on your favorite podcasting platform. And as always, we welcome your feedback.